Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Brew Strong is brought to you by Blickman Engineering, home of the Riptide. Visit them online at blickmanengineering.com.
Brewers, it's time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey.
Greetings, greetings.
Hello, fellers and gals from the middle of the country.
Hey, John.
I've got my Johns. I had a whole thing about I'd go like, hello, John, and you both go, hello. And I'd be, you know, trying to talk to either one of you saying John, and then, you know, you'd both respond at the same time. I thought it'd be hilarious, and then I thought better of it.
You know what's going to be really funny? Well, here's the deal. Today is my 59th birthday. And you guys need to sing happy birthday to me live.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear John Blickman. Happy birthday to you.
To you.
Okay, and that was
really old.
All right. So you've heard Jamil and Palmer sing, and it's not terribly impressive. Me either.
That's how we roll. We're not terribly impressive. I tell you what is terribly impressive is your fine sponsorship of this show. You've been doing this for God knows how long. Not sure why, but we really do appreciate it. And the listeners appreciate it that you pay for the show so they don't have to. And that's a very, very kind thing that you do. And I think the least they can do is go over to blickmanengineering.com, check out all the fine equipment there. One of the new cool things that is available from Blickman Engineering is this new boiler maker surface. It is electric coil bonded in a patented way, patent pending, to the surface, the bottom surface of the kettle. So when you're brewing and you want to stir or whatever, you're not whacking into your electric elements. You're not, having to clean around them, you know, disassemble these things. You just get a nice pot, you know, surface in there. So easier to clean, less intrusive, just a better all around system. Check that out. I think it's the way of the future, if you ask me. Of course, our genius resident John Blickman has come up with that thing. And that really got me thinking about modern brewing equipment and modern brewing in general. I think before we started, we were all kind of chatting about how homebrewing has changed over the years, right? Mm-hmm. I think Palmer was saying, you know, people used to brew more for, you know, you couldn't get a beer. There wasn't a lot of great beer around, so you brewed in volume. You brewed, you know, bigger batches, and you know, you had an IPA on all the time because there weren't a whole lot of IPAs available to you. Now, you know, there's 3,000 IPAs within, you know, spitting distance. And so you're brewing more for creativity or for, you know, the hobby, the love of the hobby versus, oh, I need to, you know, supply the neighborhood with beer. Now it's Blickman, you were saying, you go. You know, people have been kind of scaling back. You very rarely see people doing 10-gallon homebrew batches anymore. They do more 5-gallon, sometimes 2.5s. And so I think that syncs up with exactly what John's saying. You know, homebrewing's really morphed over time. I remember when I started, it was plastic buckets, very simplistic, a lot of old wives' tales as to how you were supposed to brew. And then we started figuring things out and improving things. And then it grew into, you had to have a, you know, a three-tier system and you know, all grain and, you know, and then
all temperature controlled.
Yes, and more advanced. And now it seems like the equipment manufacturers, you know, the yeast suppliers, the hop growers, they're all coming up with inventions and creative ways of making your life easier. So people are kind of going like, okay, yeah, I can let the new technology help me brew beer, and I can have more fun at it and have an easier time of it, is what it seems like to me. Quite an interesting shift.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I know when we first started, you know, some of these pre-hopped extract kits were all the thing, and hardly anybody did all grain. I mean, it's almost unusual to hear somebody. Those were the crazy, super advanced guys that were doing all grain. And it's kind of come full circle where a lot of the equipment is made all grain brewing super easy. And as you were also alluding to, there's so much more knowledge now mm-hmm. about why we do things, what things to do, what things really don't matter is just as important sometimes, I think. And then just people wanting to spend more of the fun time on the brewing and less on the, you know, the cleaning and the maintenance and that kind of stuff. And then just get down to just enjoying the hobby, because there's, you know, there's great beer everywhere. But we still brew because we enjoy the process, enjoy the art side with the hobby creation, enjoy just tweaking your processes for the engineers and folks that like that. And it's kind of come full circle. It's been interesting to watch over the years.
We mentioned like the transition from three-tier to, you know, single vessel or two vessel, compact vessel, you know, do you see that professionally, you know, with your propio brew systems as well, or is it mainly homebrew?
I think in what we're seeing in the nano environment is that you will get some people that do a two vessel system, but it's predominantly it's still the three vessel system. But, you know, people aren't doing like we do in homebrew. You're not doing temperature control as far as, you know, mash recirculation. That's not very common. You know, they're just single temperature rests. You're seeing less, at least, you know, we're seeing, you know, things that are simple and fast for the pro, but they have a little bit different, you know, outlook on, you know, why they're brewing. They're brewing as a business to make money. Yeah. We brew as a hobby to, you know, from everything from just the social aspect of it to just having your own handcrafted beer on tap. But it's interesting how long it took when we were doing those three-tier gravity systems. Everybody was terrified of putting wort through a pump.
Right.
You know, that was the whole thing. Oh, that's going to ruin my batch. And, you know, even though it's, you know, hot and you're boiling it. And then all of a sudden pumps became real popular and everything went horizontal, but still three systems or three vessel systems. And then you saw recirculation becoming, you know, rim systems becoming more common and less coolers, in it. But with the bigger pro systems, there's so much mass there. They just don't change temperature much. So you really don't, you know, need that setup. But we do see, systems where you're heating the liquid in the mash tun and then graining in, and you'll also be able to double batch a little bit easier if you can also have a hot liquor tank.
So I started Chris from More Beer. He, when I left Heretic and we went out to lunch, and he was like, are you going to start homebrewing again? I'm like, well, yeah, I'd like to. He's like, well, how about if I give you like a all-in-one, a Brewzilla. They have one in their scratch and dent area. And so he gave it to me. And what I realized is, yeah, just kind of the ease of, you know, an all-in-one system. You know, it's just pull this one thing off the shelf And instead of the three-tier system that I used before, now it's all kind of in one place. The pump's already integrated. It's all pretty much there. So I was thinking, well, gee, I could just ferment in this thing too. I don't even have to move the wort out. I don't even have to clean a fermenter. You know, this thing will be sanitary from having boiled wort in it. Do you think that and this is a question for John, just to make it clear. Do you think that there's going to be more done for that, that maybe that's the next step in the all-in-one fermenter or the all-in-one brewing system, that it works as a fermenter as well, that some changes or tweaks are done to make it even better as a fermenter?
You know, we've definitely got people that use it as a fermenter. Mm-hmm. I can definitely see that becoming, you know, some features that could be added. So you don't even have to move them. I remember some of the very first nano commercial systems were extract systems, and you did boil in the, you know, they were electric, and you did boil in the vessel, and then you also fermented in the vessel. And that was years ago. So it's interesting how some of these things, you know, come back. One of the things we're seeing right now is just a lot more simple fermentation devices, like, you know, the bucket fermenters, and even more simplified conical fermenters, you know, that just don't have all the stuff to, you know, basically take apart and clean. Used to be that you wanted to get it out of your boiling equipment so that you could make another batch. So some of that, the only thing, you know, there is then you've got your whole brew house tied up fermenting, mm-hmm. but I can definitely see, you know, that being a popular feature to have is, you know, be able to ferment right in that thing.
Yeah.
And John, what do you think?
I think there's a lot of merit to that. I mean, we tried with the Anvil, we had the ferment in a kettle product line for a while that never really took off. I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense to people to rack it to a clean fermenter. Mm-hmm. And I think in doing so, you do rack the beer away from a lot of Trub. Mm-hmm. That while Trub in general, you know, the hot break material and all the lipids and so on in that are valuable nutrition for the yeast, with any, you know, natural process, with any food source, you can have too much of a good thing and promote some off flavors from like too much fan, too much lipid, you know, going to the yeast. It's the kind of thing that a yeast can adapt to, but still, when we're talking about, you know, fresh pitches of yeast, too much fan, too much lipid can produce some off flavors that would be avoided by racking.
Yeah, the yeast will certainly assimilate the fatty acids, but my understanding is that it will impact staling, and so the life of your product won't be as long. I wonder though, because a lot of the British brewing had, you know, the initial, you know, 40 hours in one fermenter, and then they would drop it to another. They do the double drop. They drop it to another fermenter to add more oxygen to it and also to leave behind a lot of the Trub. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, since I love doing British beers, maybe I'll start the ferment in the all in one, and then I'll transfer out after 40 hours once the yeast is really kicking, give it another dose of oxygen and get it off the Trub and see what happens. If I get a better result, because I'm very keen to do the double drop.
That's an interesting idea. I was doing another podcast a couple of weeks ago about open fermentation, and you know, you can kind of see the transition in British brewing, you know, with the double drop of, you know, going from open fermentation to a closed double drop fermentation to today's cylindrical conical, where we know we've got to inject this much oxygen into the mix for it to complete.
Well, and a lot of the you know, the hazy yeasts that are popular today, you have to put they're sourced from British strains, and you have to put a ton of oxygen in them to get them to really ferment fully. And I think that's, you know, harkens back to their life as you know, British yeast being open fermenters, being doing the drop, etc. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, I want to kind of touch on more of the, you know, fermentation changes as well, you know, fermenter tools and yeasts and all that stuff. We'll be back right after this.
Are you looking for a simple brewing system that's great for all grain brewing, but everything on the market seems to be full of compromises? Blickman Engineering has the answer. The Blickman Brew Easy All Grain Brewing System. The Brew Easy is a complete system with easy upgrades and a beautiful compact design, perfect for any size brewing location. At its core, the Brew Easy is built on two gorgeous Blickman Boilermaker brew kettles, a high temperature March pump, and either a top tier gas burner or the new boil coil electric heater. The Brew Easy adapter lid allows the pots to stack on top of each other, forming an efficient, strong, and compact brewing setup that comes in 5, 10, and 20-gallon batch sizes. Upgrade your BrewEasy system with full automated control by adding a Blickman Tower of Power temp controller and make moving around easy with the Blickman Kettle Cart. The BrewEasy is modular. If you already own a Boilermaker kettle, you can build your BrewEasy by purchasing just the modules you need. The new BrewEasy all-grain brewing system. See it today at BlickmanEngineering.com and brew with Blickman quality on your new BrewEasy. Easy.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking modern home brewing with two of my favorite Johns, John Palmer and John Blickman. And we were just talking about, you know, British fermentation, fermenting in an all-in-one. You know, one of the things that I've seen, and I've been interested in for a number of years, and now I'm starting to see them show up in the pro area, is these little devices that you drop into your fermentation, and they transmit a signal telling you the specific gravity of the batch. Have you guys used those?
I haven't like these digital hydrometers, ferment, you know, ferment bugs or whatever their, you know, product name. Yeah.
I think it was one. I think one of the first ones is the brew bug. I think.
Yeah.
I remember. Yeah. And then the tilt came out, and then the Play-Doh.
Yeah.
So very familiar with them. I've not used them. I'm also the guy that never opens the top of the fermenter to look at it.
Right. And there's another one somebody was coming out with, which was a digital airlock, which didn't go in the beer. It just monitored the and measured the amount of CO2 coming out.
Yeah. Isn't that the Play-Doh?
Oh, maybe.
I think that's how that one works.
Yeah. Which I'm with you. I don't like dropping anything into the beer, you know, once it's going. And I never got into it because I like taking a sample, getting a pH, things like that, because the pH is quite important as well to track in, especially in commercial brewing. Do you think anything that this is going to continue? I see more and more people talking about it and saying they're using it. I've seen some people say they don't work that well because they get, you know, the Baronhof you know, builds up on them during ferment and kind of, mm-hmm. you know, makes them read incorrectly. But I've also seen things track pretty closely. They say just kind of at the end, it's a little bit off, but not that far off. It kind of tells mm-hmm. you when you're getting a stable reading, you know, yeah, it's probably done fermenting.
You know, I would kind of think that just having that information that things are progressing, whether or not it's accurate. I mean, you would be able to tell, okay, it's, you know, it's past high Kroisen and I can do this part of my process. I can add hops at this time, you know, because right. I'm pretty sure I'm past high Kroisen, and you don't have to open up to see if things have fallen mm-hmm. or any of that other kind of stuff. Using glass carboy, you can just see it, but.
Well, that's why I like glass.
Yeah.
But what's happening in fermenter technology? Is that going to be, and again, this is a question for John, you know, are we going to start seeing like glass cylinder conicals? Are we going to start seeing, this digital hydrometer technology built in? Are we going to see, I think you mentioned previously that we're now seeing pressurizable or pressure vessels for the cylinder conicals. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, we did the, well, one of the very first, you know, other than converted kegs, the Cornicle is a product that we came out with a number of years ago. We actually did some pressure fermentation tests, Chris White and I, on, you know, the, you know, having, you know, a traditional lager, you know, at cold temperatures, a room temperature, and then three room temperature fermentations, one at 0 bar, you know, atmospheric pressure, one at 1 bar, and then another one at 2 bar. And, you know, there was definitely differences in the flavor, and both analytically and just tasting, of the three beers. And it really turned out that about 1 bar seemed to make the closest to a lager profile. But it was interesting. It, they were so low, almost, you know, had hardly any diacetyl in them. It almost tasted a little too clean. It's almost like they didn't have some of that body that the diacetyl can perceive as. So we've seen some of those, and then we've seen a lot. You know, most of the cylinder conicals you'll see now are pressure capable. You know, SS. Spike, you know, we've got one, and More Beer does as well. And those are like at 1 bar, which is about, you know, fine for where you want to be for those pressure fermentations. But we've also then seen on the yeast side where they've got yeast, like the Kvite yeast and others that really produce a fairly close representation to the lager profiles. And then some of the, you know, some of the other products, you know, we've got in our Anvil line, just very simple to clean products that, you know, they're pressure capable to, you know, a PSI or so, you know, pretty low, enough to do, you know, transfers, a CO2 transfer. But, you know, in general, I'm a fan of just letting gravity do its thing and not going out of your way to introduce oxygen into the system. But
I'll tell you this, gravity's doing its thing on me. That's for sure. I can tell.
Yeah.
The Lallemand has their Nova Lager out now, which is, you know, they get it. It's interesting. UC Davis has a, I don't know, some way of getting yeast to not produce any sulfur or very minimal sulfur. And then it also, you know, this stuff works, you know, they've bred it. It's not GMO. They've bred it to, you know, produce a clean lager like product, you know, at higher temperatures, you know, wider range of temperatures. And, you know, to, you know, very low VDK, you know, extremely low sulfur. And so it seems like a lot's being done with that. And I think, you know, what kind of sparked that was the whole Kvite yeast thing where everybody wanted to start doing using those to make lagers. And then it's kind of like, it's not quite a lager. And so I think, you know, some of the yeast producers are starting to look at, well, how can we make a, you know, a better warm temperature, you know, lager experience? So I think it's fascinating that, you know, all these areas are kind of moving forward. Another one that I picked up at the homebrew conference, which John and I were at in San Diego, was this little bad boy here. Soft Brew BR8. It is it's Brett, dried Brett. I mean,
interesting. Cool.
Yeah. They were saying it took them quite a lot of experimentation and work to develop the ability to dry Brett and produce that. So, you know, for people around the world where shipping liquid is not the best idea, you know, now you get the dry packs. And I think that's tremendous. That's a huge change forward. You know, there's a lot more yeast being available dry. I mean, look at the strains that are available today compared to when John and I started.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Pretty much started around the same time. I don't know.
It came in the can with the dust on top.
It was stuck. It was stuck to the lid of the can, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You had your Australian, your English, the American, and Belgian.
It was just yeast. It didn't at that time. And then they started doing that. And you could have your choice of two or three different yeasts. And and then it kind of got up to like eight. And now it's, they're coming out with a huge number. I'm sure they have just a few of them that are the bulk of all their sales, probably like, US 05, or, that's pretty much that clean ale yeast is probably the thing for everybody. But it's interesting that they're really pushing the boundaries now and not just doing more of the standard brewing strains, but now they're doing things like Brett, which is really cool. It opens up a wide range of stuff for brewers these days.
Yeah, and it's really been interesting to watch how the dry yeast, which were considered very much inferior to the liquid pure cultured yeast, how they really have become, especially in the nano environment. You're seeing a lot of brewers. We see a lot of brewers that are using the dry yeast and not repitching the yeast, or not very frequently repitching the yeast, just for the economy and the ease of use and ease of storage.
Yes.
And the varieties that they're coming out with are just, pretty amazing, the different dry yeast varieties that are out there now, and how they've improved the quality of the and just the purity and the viability of those yeasts has been pretty interesting to watch.
Yeah, I think we're going to continue to see that. We're going to see more dry yeast strains tailored for specific styles. I've known, it'll keep on evolving. It'll be a surprise each year, I think, what's new and available.
Yeah, they've really been, pushing the boundaries and pushing the technology. Gone are the days where, you kind of had to put up with a bunch of bacteria in your yeast, and half of it died when you poured it into your wort. Now they're getting really good survival rates just direct pitching dry yeast. I still like to
rehydrate,
kind of proof my yeast to start.
I do that out of habit too.
Yeah,
I even do it for winemaking, rehydrate it.
That's right. It's so easy. It's not as difficult as people think, but
it adds joy to the hobby.
Right.
You see like the two extremes, people that I just want to make something that is good palatable beer, and I want to do it as quickly and easy as possible. And then you've got the other extreme, which is, people wanting to, do it like, the old style and the traditional lagers. They do make, just great, very good representations of the traditional lagers, but it also takes several, weeks to do that. You got to have the patience for that. You got to enjoy having the equipment to do the temperature control. And, there's a lot of space and stuff involved with doing some of that. So it's, to me, it's what are you really getting out of the hobby? And to remember that this is a hobby, and you don't always have to do it the way the pros do. And, if you, for example, if you just want to make a nice German Pilsner, and you're okay if it's, not exactly as clean as it could be if you did it traditional way, but it's good for you, then, by all means do that, and just recognize that it's not going to be perfect. That's okay.
Yeah. John Blickman, I think your mic is rubbing against your face there.
There we go. Sorry.
There you go. That's all right. Well, and John Palmer, you edit the materials.
ATQ, yeah.
Right. And have you seen anything interesting, new technologies, kind of, new science that's coming down the pipe for everybody?
I think, well, we're seeing new digital technology coming into the industry. you know, ways to improve the efficiency of brewing operations, better monitoring. They're talking about incorporating AI into the decision making. But a lot of it really rolls back to, we just have a better understanding today of what the yeast are trying to do and what they need to do it. Charlie Bamforth just put out a great article in the JIB about, you know, making a case for no long lagering. There are ample technical alternatives to long maturation. We can clean up the beer in the fermenter with various, you know, enzymes like ALDC for diacetyl and stuff. We have a better understanding of, you know, warm maturation versus cold. Just a whole, you know, list of reasons why we don't need long lagering times anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of understanding of what it is that we're trying to do, it kind of is going to inform our home brewing techniques as well as our nano and craft brewing.
Yeah, it's fascinating, you know, the progress that's being made. One question I have is, you know, what have you guys seen in progress in hops? Let's do this. Let's take another short break. And when we come back, I want to talk about what's happening in the world of hops right after this.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. Talking with two of my favorite Johns right here. John Blickman, proud sponsor of the Brew Strong on the Brew Network. And John Palmer, a dear friend and co-author on Brewing Classic Styles. And, you know, 15 years of doing this show. Let's not forget that. So before the break, I had mentioned, you know, hops, new hop stuff. When I was at the homebrew conference in San Diego, I saw, I have the pint glass. I forget the name. I've got his card here somewhere talking about new hop products. One of the things, here it is, Blue Lake Hops, Adrian Cook. He was showing me how they have figured out a way to kind of cryopack the fresh hops. So they take the fresh hop harvest. And a lot of the ones I've seen in the past, if you just take fresh hops and you freeze them and you try and use them later, you end up with a slimy, nasty mess of, you know, plant matter in your beer. It doesn't work. But he showed me this preserved bag of hops, and it felt to me exactly like fresh hops do. It seemed to have all the same moisture, the same, you know, feel of the cones. And so I was pretty intrigued. And then I know, you know, commercially, you know, Hopsteiner, they were coming out with a bunch of different things, and Yakima was coming out with a bunch of different things. You know, they're taking the hops and separating out all the kind of components of the hops. So if you want more of, you know, the alpha acid, you know, for bittering, and, you know, you can use just that, or you want, you know, these aromatic oils, you can use just that, or you can use every little part of the hops separately. Have you seen much of that in the journals, in the technical quarterly, or you know, have you seen the hop rocket was something, you know, John Blickman came out with, you know, quite a while ago. Or is there new equipment coming to process hops? Or
there are, especially at the nano level, nano and craft, you're seeing more devices to help dry hop with less oxygen ingress. You know, whether they're you know, like airlock systems or hop cannons that blow the hops in or drop them in under a purge atmosphere. We're seeing lots of hop extracts these days, different types of extracts. As you say, you know, they're able to separate groups of components, the oils, the beta acids, the alpha acids. And I think, you know, in terms of popular styles, hazy IPA, West Coast IPA, it's really helpful in terms of economy and saving money with just raw hops to be able to use extracts to get that base bitterness that you need, or to put in a signature, you know, note, you know, hop oil note that you need, that you want, rather than trying to achieve it with massive dry hopping. And then, of course, losing some of that character to the waste green matter that comes out of the beer, you know, before packaging. Understanding those balances is where a lot of research has gone in the last, you know, 10 years. Thiols are another huge area of innovation with hops. That's the hot topic these days, you know, releasing thiols from hops and using that to generate more fruity character in the beer. We have thiolized yeasts, or, you know, yeast that have been bred or, you know, created to have the enzyme to break off and degrade those thiols into aroma compounds. Interestingly, the malt and the grains themselves are a much larger source of these bound thiols than the hops are. Mm-hmm. So even if you don't put in hops that contain thiol precursors and you use those yeast, you'll still generate lots of fruity character because the thiols from the grain will react the same way. Yeah, so there's a lot of, I think, innovation in hop products that we're going to see. I think, you know, we all heard at HomebrewCon and other recent events that West Coast IPAs are kind of making a comeback. We really rode the hazy craze for a while, and everybody's looking back to the drier, more bitter IPAs as, you know, as a change. Mm-hmm. I think that'll continue to swing back and forth. We're also seeing a lot more lagers being produced these days. At the recent World Beer Cup, I think German Pils was, I think, the second highest category behind IPAs.
Right.
So yeah,
it's really coming on.
Yeah. I think we're going to see more interest in those, more targeted hop products to that and similar styles. Mm-hmm. What do you think, John?
I personally have been heading back towards some of the, you know, the West Coast IPAs just for that dry crispness, and also just back to plain old American pale ales like I brewed when I first started brewing in the 90s. And then also trending towards a lot of the, you know, just maltier beers. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the beer that I've been brewing has been just a classic old American amber. Yeah. In fact, I use the recipe that you guys have in Brewing Classic Styles, and it's just absolutely perfect representation. You know, it's not an over hopped or an over an over crystal malted pale ale. You know, it's its own style, and it's just a great, easy to drink beer. And then there's been a big resurgence, but an actual, you know, market that's been developing for non-alcoholic beers or very low alcohol
beers. Right.
You know, and that's just nice. I mean, so you can have a, you know, two or three pints in a night and not have all the carbs and, you know, have motivation after dinner to actually do something.
Yeah, they have a yeast. What is it? NA1 or something like that, that only ferments the glucose and does not ferment the maltose. And so you get just a touch of fermentation. When we experimented with non-alcoholic, you needed a little bit of fermentation character in there for it to taste like a beer. Otherwise, it just tastes like malt water.
Yeah.
that's another new thing that's coming out. John, you heard John mention about
too many Johns.
people wanting to. You can't have too many Johns. Trust me. People were finding out new ways to dry hop, excluding as much oxygen as possible. You think there's something in the future of homebrew? You know, maybe a different version of the hop rocket or something that some device that you completely flush the oxygen from your hops and then transfer them into the fermenter some way?
We actually have a product, and it's called the Aromanator.
The Aromanator. All right.
Had to come up with that aider, and we had a new product. Yes. So we got to have a product that can use the aider end again, Ferminator, kind of stuff. But and it does just that. It's got a clear top on it, so you can see that all the hops have fallen, and it's got a purge port at the bottom, so that you can purge all the oxygen out of the hops after you put them in. And then a valve that you open, and then it will dump the hops out. And it's got a little purge port at the top. You pull a little D-ring, and it'll let the air and oxygen out as you're purging it. You know, so it's not a pressurized, depressurized. You know, you're actually just flushing the oxygen out and dropping it down.
Nice.
That's a product we've had for a year.
Does it have a little self-destruct button too?
We can put one in there.
If something happens to the first one, does another one come from the future and show up?
Oh, it does, but it's a much friendlier one that comes the second time, or is that the third time? I can't remember how many of those they had, but
well, and Steve Hiller, if you listen live to these shows, you can participate on Facebook on the Brewery Network page. And you see the video playing, you can just go to the comment section, and you can ask your questions or comment on what you're hearing right there. And Steve Hiller was mentioned, you know, West Coast Pilsner seems to be the in thing. Essentially what John was saying. See, I think everybody knows who I'm talking about when I say John. I think it's just very self-explanatory. Yeah, I would agree with that, 100%. People were wanting to brew, German style Pilsners and, get that clean. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people really need to work on the fermentation, but, a lot of places are doing an excellent job of it. And then it was kind of like, okay, well, I really like this, but I also like the hoppiness. And so we're seeing a lot of West Coast Pilsner type of things around where I live. It seems to be one of the things everybody's kind of keying in on. So, that has really finally come to pass in the market. I mean, people talked about that for at least a decade. It's a thing. Oh, it's the next great thing.
Yeah.
It's like, but then they snuck a New England IPA in there on us. So,
Jamal, here's a question for you. What is the difference, in your opinion, between a cold IPA and a West Coast lager?
So I get that question quite a bit, and I was answering it the other day. I really don't think there is much of a difference. I was talking to a friend of mine, Rick at Stereo Brewing, excellent brewery down near Anaheim. If you ever down visiting Disneyland, you got to get yourself out to Stereo. The guy's a master brewer and doing really a wonderful job with everything he brews. And I was asking, he had a cold IPA. I'm like, okay, so I posed the question to him. I'm like, what's the difference between that and like an IPL? And he's like, yeah, it's just better marketing, better marketing. And I think someone claimed to have invented, cold IPA. I think it's just, people have been doing kind of India pale lagers for a long time. And I think it just was a terrible name. Nobody really it just never caught on. And then cold IPA kind of caught on. I assume some people are just cold fermenting using ale yeast. Some people use a lager yeast. I don't know. I'm not really sure what the definition exactly is, but I recently read some stuff about somebody claiming that they invented it and they were angry at everybody else, or I don't know what it was.
Like the black IPA thing, that it was such an oxymoron that
yes.
That always kind of was just a weird name.
Right. I think, you know, naming really is important. And I think, you know, by changing IPA to IPL, I think that kind of did something negative. You know, New England IPA works because it's got IPA in the name. And, you know, I think cold IPA works because it's got IPA in the name. And people are looking for IPA. And if you can give them any variation of IPA, great. They just need IPA in the name.
Right.
What do you guys think as far as, you know, John Palmer? What's your definition of cold IPA versus IPL or just a, you know?
My understanding of cold IPA is that it's a cream ale that's been hopped to IPA levels. So my understanding is there should be 25%-ish of, you know, corn or rice adjunct in it to lighten the body. And then you can either do it, you know, ale yeast fermented cold, lager yeast fermented warm, mm-hmm. You know, either way, and then West Coast lager, IPL. The IPLs, you know, of 10 years ago, I never cared for them. They are always too sulfury for me. But I've had some West Coast lagers recently that have been quite nice. And I think it's because they've moved away from the strictly noble hops where to get, you know, 60, 70 IBUs out of noble hops, you just had so much green matter and really sulfury hop character that I think it ruined the beer. Whereas if you go with higher alpha hops, some of the newer hop varieties that have less sulfur character to them, I think you get a cleaner beer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't. I'll tell you this: a lot of people are not brewing a cream ale and putting corn in it and all that stuff. They're just, you know, kind of either using lager yeast or going cold on their IPA fermentation, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah. Okay. The
majority of people. It's an interesting. I think I've heard exactly that what you're saying about the cream ale though. Let's see, Glenn Henry from Norway. He says, "Hi, greetings from Norway. Have you tried drip hopping?"
Not sure I know what that is. Drip hopping mean like the dogfish method, dribbling right, them in over the course of the boil?
Where they would take the little football game that vibrates, the little vibrated table, put off in there. It's continuous dry hopping. I guess
it's a little auger that feeds it.
Yeah, I guess. Although,
or is he really meaning that in the dry hopping form, as opposed to the boil end?
Oh, another technique that Denny and Drew were talking about. What was that? Taking a portion of wort and steeping the hops in it,
yes,
and then adding that back.
Dip hopping is a technique for brewing beer that involves steeping hops in warm water or wort in the fermenter. The technique was developed by brewers at Japan's Spring Valley Brewery in 2012. Dip hopping can help accentuate pleasant hop aromas while suppressing hop off flavors. It can also maximize the aroma properties of hops without adding to bitterness. Some general steps hopping. For dip hopping. Steep hops in warm water or wort in the fermenter. Transfer chilled wort into the fermenter to combine with the hop tea, pitch yeast. I can tell you, I wouldn't do it. and the reason why is I do not like beers that have been fermented with the hops in them. You just extract so much of kind of a harsh bitterness. When we were working on hazy IPAs, we, you know, everyone's like, oh no, you have to have the hops in there for biotransformation. And so we tried hopping the same wort, dry hopping the same wort, you know, at the start of fermentation or after fermentation had completed. And everybody preferred the after fermentation completed. One, you don't get as much volatilization blow off of your hop compounds from the active scrubbing of the CO2. And two, you're not leaving all that hop matter. When you stir that stuff up and you keep it in contact, it extracts, you know, just terrible stuff from the leaf matter. And nobody liked it in blind tasting. So I would never do it. That's my, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't think you want hop leaf matter in fermentation. I think you want it in the whirlpool when you extract all the compounds that you want.
Leave it behind. Yeah.
And then leave the green stuff behind. And then you can add it at the end. And it sounds like dip hopping, if you're steeping the hops in wort or warm water at 160 degrees Fahrenheit, that sounds like what people are doing with whirlpool hopping these days. So you cool your wort down to, you know, 175 Fahrenheit, or, you know, if you want to do it 160, you do 160, add your hops to it, circulate it in the whirlpool, and then draw off the clear wort into your fermenter. Now you've removed all those hop compounds from the hops, you've got in your fermenter, and you've left behind the green matter that is the problem in fermentation, I think. And so that certainly works. So I just don't understand why.
Is he talking about doing it after fermentation, you know, like towards the end or towards the beginning, like after Hykroisin or before?
They're talking about doing it before fermentation. So you take your,
because that sounds a lot like just a hop stand at 160 degrees or whatever. But it'd be interesting, you know, if you're doing that after Hykroisin, and then you're getting a decent bit of those compounds. I'm not sure how much of the super voluble volatile compound you'll lose in, right, you know, 160 degree, 140 degree steep. But then if you do that after Hykroisin, you know, and you put your hop tea in, it'd be interesting to see if that's what they're talking about.
Here's a little bit more on their findings. So the findings show that a low temperature hop addition in between the whirlpool and dry hop additions in the fermentation vessel created a distinct effect. Fruity and tropical qualities derived from linalool and geraniol were amplified, but piney and dank myrcene-related flavors were suppressed. Additional effects of dip hopping noted by the Kieran team were increased fermentation rate due to a reduction in dissolved CO2. Well, yeah, you just stir off your CO2. And reduced levels of an onion-like off flavor, which was attributed to decreased hydrogen sulfide levels resulting from CO2 purging conducted during the dip hop addition. Like whirlpool hopping, dip hop additions help preserve volatile aromatics, and like dry hop additions, the extended contact in the fermentation vessel creates opportunities for biotransformation. In a nutshell, hops are added to the fermenter before fermentation begins, typically a rate of 3/4 to 1 pound per barrel. Dip hops can be slurried with water or wort at a similar temperature to whirlpool additions, 150 to 170. Fahrenheit, and left in contact for 60 minutes or longer prior to pumping in cooled wort and pitching the yeast. So it's before fermentation.
It sounds like you'd lose a lot of that just from CO2 scrubbing during fermentation.
So it sounds like it is
nice that you don't have the green stuff.
Well, no, this includes the green stuff.
Oh, I'm
putting the whole thing in there. This is essentially fermentation hopping. But before you add the wort, you're first mixing it with some hot water.
So yeah, first wort hopping, and then into the fermenter.
Yeah, I mean they're putting the hops in the fermenter, mixing it with 160 degree Fahrenheit water, and then putting the cold wort in, and then pitching the yeast and fermenting. So
interesting. I was assuming they were separating it.
I mean, perhaps it has some sort of effect on it, but yeah, I would just add it to the whirlpool. I see no difference in that versus adding it to the whirlpool and removing the hops from the whirlpool, adding the clear wort. I mean, they say they're getting a difference, but the difference seems to be attributed to agitating causing. How is it breaking out CO2? It must be, well, from the particulate matter or from, unless you're adding it once fermentation's begun, but that's not what it's saying. So interesting. Yeah. Brennan is saying it's a big pre-fermentation dry hop that is steeped on a small portion of the batch, 160 degree wort. Should be an alternative to dry hopping to avoid hop creep. You're not going to get the same effect as dry hopping with this technique. I can guarantee you that. That is, it just is not going to happen. Dry hopping is very unique. Nothing replaces dry hopping. I think the thing about dry hopping and hop creep, yeah, that's the interesting question though. Good job bringing that up. Let's take one more quick break. And when we come back, we'll wrap up with some thoughts right after this.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer into beer. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We just had a rousing discussion of dip hopping, and you know, of course, like usual, I am just poo-pooing the whole idea.
It sounds complicated.
it would take work. I don't know.
I view it as, hey, can that be another gizmo that I could fiddle with and design? Right. That's the fun part for me. Yeah,
that's cool. Yeah, I just don't like having a whole bunch of hops mixed in with my yeast. And for, you know, for even as a home brewer, I would always harvest and repitch my yeast. So I'm not keen on having a whole bunch of hops mixed in with it because that just causes
viability problems.
And I'm not a big fan of having them in for, you know, seven days.
For ferment.
You get such a grassy character to them. Yeah. I've noticed, you know, just get them in there and get them out as quickly as you can.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Now I'm going to have to just read up on this.
Yes. It's for dips. Dip hopping. No.
The dipinator.
The dipinator, new product. You heard it here first. Expect the dipinator on store shelves
by Christmas. There you go.
Can people have a discount code to get their dipinator at a discount if they order five of them before Christmas?
Yes. There you go. It's dip for five.
Dip for five. Five dips. Cool. All right. So what haven't we covered off? What sort of technology is coming down that we haven't covered off?
Well, we haven't talked about malts.
Right.
And malts are being, you know, bred to have less precursors, you know, DMS precursors. They're being bred to have less haze problems.
Or more haze problems.
Yeah, that too. Certainly the enzyme, you know, there is still very high in enzymes, diastatic power. Mm-hmm. But I think they are trying to move or find malts that have better inherent shelf stability for the beer. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that's coming down the pipe.
Well, and it seems like you know, in the past, malt was produced by and for the big brewers. And that was really the focus. And then it started shifting a bit towards more, you know, the craft brewer. And now it seems like they're coming out with new products really targeting the craft brewer and the home brewer.
Yeah. And gluten sensitivity is recently entered my life. And I had the opportunity to try some gluten-free beers brewed with millet, buckwheat, oats, and forget what else. Mm-hmm. But very very palatable. I mean, you got to get over the fact that they don't taste like barley because there's no barley in them. Mm-hmm. And you got to set that aside. But once you set that aside, they really are cereal-based beer-like beverages that are very palatable, especially, I mean, I had a double IPA that mm-hmm. was, you know, every bit of all the merit of its own thing compared to, say, Pliny.
Is that, you know, preferable for some reason versus using like Brewer's Clarex?
Yes. Reducing the gluten? Because unfortunately they have found that Brewer's Clarex, while it does break up the molecule that is detected by the antigen tests that are currently mm-hmm. used to decide whether something that contains gluten or not, it doesn't break it down to the extent that a truly gluten sensitive or celiac disease person needs to not have a reaction. So and there's a spectrum of gluten sensitivity to, you know, anything, you know, from like people who are lactose intolerant and, you know, mild discomfort mm-hmm. from drinking milk, same thing with gluten, to mm-hmm. you know, someone that goes into anaphylactic shock because of drinking something with gluten. Mm-hmm. In my own case, I've noticed that I experience mild stomach discomfort, you know, when judging or having a pizza, you know, large portion of.
I just power through it. You know.
Yeah.
Stay close.
Grab
to the
Pepto, chug it down. Yeah. You know.
The pizza I ate last night. I mean, you know, yeah. Nothing was going to stop me consuming that.
Yeah, but you know, the whole area, I guess, in terms of malts. Mm-hmm. And new malts made from gluten-free cereals mm-hmm. is another area where we're going to see a lot more development in the near future.
Interesting.
And I think, you know, these beers truly deserve their own styles. We mm-hmm. shouldn't say that this is a gluten-free, you know, German Pilsner. No, it's its own thing. We kind of got to get away from that we're trying to say, oh, it's the next best thing to a Pilsner. Mm-hmm.
It's its own grain base, you know, perhaps millet based beers.
They should have their own categories.
Interesting. And what about enzymes? You kind of touched on enzymes a little bit. It seems like there's a lot of work being done, a lot of new enzymes coming to market that do things like, you know, make a beer clear and reduce, you know, the a bit
diacetyl of diacetyl. Enzymes are another area where we're going to see a lot of products because they can answer very specific mm-hmm. needs, especially for the commercial brewer where you're trying to get the best efficiency, get the best throughput of your product, you know, from mm-hmm. your system.
Do you think we'll see that for homebrewers more and more? Do you think?
I think so. I think you'll see ALDC. I'm pretty sure it's already available to reduce diacetyl, mm-hmm. reduce hop creep, diacetyl, and other things. Brewer's Clarex and other enzymes that can, and beta glucanases are another, especially when it comes to gluten-free brewing where you actually need diastatic enzymes and the glucanases to mm-hmm. help convert those mashes because the gelatinization temperature is higher than the alpha amylase temperature range.
Interesting. Yeah, it's a great time to be a brewer. I think really has, you know, kind of come full circle from, you know, it was a simple thing that you did for fun, through mm-hmm. you know, became quite technical and, you know, larger, and then I think that spawned a lot of people to open up craft breweries, and then it's kind of come back to, no, we're just having fun, we're just enjoying it and trying different things, and you know, the new technology is cool too. It makes brewing more fun and easier to get a quality result. So very cool.
Yeah, it's been really interesting just seeing how things shift and move with not only just time, but, you know, different generations and what their preferences and needs out of a hobby or wants out of a hobby are. And, you know, it's, you know, people would come to us and say, what do I need to of your stuff to make beer? And I'm like, well, you really just need a plastic bucket and some malt extract and you can make beer. It's like, what do you want out of the hobby?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and from there it's, you know, listen to Brew Strong and read how to brew. And a lot of that can answer their questions about how involved do I want to be? They'll either eat that stuff up mm-hmm. and, you know, wow, that's just the, you know, the fun part of the hobby is the technical part, mm-hmm. or they'll just say, no, I'm not really interested in that. I'm just going to stay in chapter one. I just like the cooking part of mm-hmm. the beer, you know, mm-hmm. and both of those are okay. And it's interesting just to see how it just changes so much, over the time we've been brewing.
It is a great hobby and, it's brought me a lot of great friends like you two guys. Really enjoyed, spending the time. Thanks for doing the show. I think it was quite interesting. I think people are going to get a lot out of it. If you enjoy the show, make sure to check out our fine sponsor, Blickman Engineering. You check them out at blickmanengineering.com. And if you could do me a favor, send a nice email to this man here, John Blickman. You can send it to feedback@blickmanengineering.com and just tell him how much you appreciate that he has paid for the show so you can listen to it for free over the last, oh man, it's coming up like 17 years, something like that. I don't know. It's been a long time. And it really has made a difference in a lot of people's brewing careers. So much appreciated. Check out the Blickman Engineering site. You can also ask for Blickman products at all your fine homebrew shops. If they don't have it, they can get it. So check them out. Until then, everybody, brew strong.
Brew strong.
Brew on, brew strong.